Well, the original title, the working title of this book was Slipstreaming, which I guess is used in skateboarding.
I would not know.
I just looked it up and thought, oh, I like that.
It's a cool name. Yeah, it's a cool word.
To be in someone's slipstream, or like, you know, like geese flying. They're kind of being pulled by the draft of the bird ahead of them. So I sort of envisioned Joan doing that. And slipstream is also like it's a watery term too.
Yeah.
So I have a real affinity for water, I think. Mm-hmm. And the Danube River, or Dunaj in Slovak, is very, it's very evocative, very kind of, it's a very important river for Europe, and for many reasons, historical and cultural and, you know, all sorts of things. So, mm-hmm. I see rivers as kind of carriers of those things.
Where the Silver River Ends is a new novel that dives deep into themes of mixed race identity, systemic oppression, family reconciliation, and forging one's own path. Author Anna Kwan joins me this week to chat about the book's decades ago roots in a Slovak summer, why she needed time away from Nova Scotia to write it, and how she finds the right metaphor. I'm Tara Thorne, and this is The Tideline. Good day. A public service announcement. Popcorn is back at the movies. Stop asking me about it. It's there. Go buy it. And grab a bag on your way in to see Wildhood, the queer Indigenous coming-of-age drama directed by Breton Hannum, which is opening in town on Friday. Brett stopped by this show on their way to TIFF last year, and you can dig back in the archives to September 21 for that episode. And the film also opened the Atlantic International Film Festival. It's a beautifully shot and acted story of a teen named Link on a journey to find a mother he thought had died. And in the process, he undergoes an awakening. That film also nominated for 6 Canadian Screen Awards. So we're in this weird phase 2 before we throw the whole bag off the bridge and reopen the province on March 21. So good luck to everyone, including our friend Rich O'Coin, who is one of the most dedicated road warriors out there. And I can't imagine how him having to stay at home for 2 years has been for his mental state. But he is down in the U.S. now, finally touring in support of his pandemic record, United States, which came out in September 2020. So good luck out there, Rich. From that, here's This Is It.
Like it was yesterday, and it's all she recalls anyway, 'cause she's
Where the Silver River Ends is a lyrical meeting of family drama and magical folktale written by Anna Kwan, the third in a series featuring some of the same characters. Anna joins me in studio now. Hi, Anna.
Hi, Tara.
Thanks so much for coming on the show. We were like co-workers-ish probably 20 years ago.
That's right.
When I first started at The Coast, you were writing for The Coast.
Yeah.
But we never worked together.
No.
Well, I'm glad that we're seeing each other now.
Yeah.
So congratulations on this book, Where the Silver River Ends. It's so beautiful. I had to read it in chunks because it was stirring up too much. I would have to stop. So can you tell me about sort of the process of writing it? It seems like it's been in the works for a long time. You spent a summer in Slovakia?
Well, that was 30 years ago that
wow.
I spent time in Slovakia. Where the Silver River Ends is my third novel. Mm-hmm. And I was just looking back on my time there, drawing from my time there to sort of set the novel, which was, the setting is a little, people call it blurry. I'm not very detailed or specific about the setting, but
right.
But my mind and heart were there when I was writing it.
Cool. Well, what about your time there stuck with you long enough to kind of craft a narrative around it?
Well, it was it was pretty much just after I finished university. I did a Bachelor of Arts in English at Dal and then became a daycare teacher for like 6 months and decided that wasn't for me. And the Velvet Revolution was just happening when the Berlin Wall had fallen and
right.
And the communists in Czechoslovakia, as it was then called, had fallen. And they were looking for a volunteer English teacher. So I went for 8 months and it was like the most wonderful experience of my life, really, at the time. But I'd already had experience of depression mm-hmm. and when I was at the end of my stay in Slovakia, I really crashed. And so I had a wonderful and terrible experience there.
Okay.
And I made some very dear friends who I haven't really kept up with or they haven't kept up with me for quite a few years, but they're still really dear to me.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a very special time of my life.
And are they, you don't have to say who's who or anything like that, but are they in this story in a way?
They are not, but okay. There's one character, there's the character of Milan looks a little bit like one of the friends I had there.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's really quite a fictional, fictional novel.
Cool. I'm bad at summarizing. I meander off. So I feel like you probably have it down to a science now that you're promoting the book.
No, I do not. Don't ask me.
So, well, it's about the lead character's name is Joan, and she
yes.
is teaching English. And she has an incident where she ends up in Slovakia quite quickly.
Yes.
And, meets these friends, and then a friend of hers, see, I'm already meandering. A friend of hers, you can just confirm, a friend of hers from Canada, her mother's boyfriend's daughter comes over yeah. and stays with them, and they're just sort of making their way through this city together. Mm-hmm. I am interested in why you said it in 2005.
2005.
Because there's no cell phones. Which I thought right. was super notable. So when Joan's kind of wandering around, she needs someone to guide her. She kind of needs maps. She finds her yeah. way.
Well, actually, that wasn't the reason, but that is a good point. in my first novel, Joan. So I have written three novels, and the first novel, Joan was the main character. The second novel, Adriana was the narrator.
Right.
And so Joan had gone to Hungary, and this was just about the right time for her to decide to take off and also for Adriana to be able to come meet her.
Mm-hmm.
So it was the earliest point in their respective stories that I could bring them together.
Cool. And you do hand – is that one of the reasons then that you hand the story over to Adriana occasionally? As a narrator?
You know, that was my editor Stephanie's brainwave.
Heard of her. Yeah.
<I know>. Stephanie Domet, yes. Who is like a god to me.
Yeah, same.
And she, so, you know, I tend to just write the story, get it down, and it's pretty, like, I don't know, probably boring for a lot of people, straightforward, and then I have to sort of play with it a bit to make it more interesting. And I didn't give Adriana enough of a voice, I think, as on her, like, as on her own as a character. Mm-hmm. And I think Stephanie suggested that I do some scenes in her voice, to make it more clear that she was a real player in this. Mm-hmm. Like, she's not just some character that just sort of wandered in and wandered out. But, and I really like those sections, actually. If I was going to write it again, I kind of wondered whether I would write it in, like, with Joan speaking in the first person from her point of view.
Yeah, I did wonder about that, because Adriana is in the first person and Joan is not. Mm-hmm. Yeah, which it's, but it also, and I'm just guessing, because I also know Stephanie, that this is, it's sort of, it shakes you up a little bit to, like, switch the voice.
That's right.
Even in the story, it switches you up a little bit. Yeah. So, am I correct that you moved to Toronto for a few months to actually write this?
I did. I I got a grant from Arts Nova Scotia, not as much as I asked for, not enough to pay my way totally, but I have family in Toronto that I wanted to see, and I also just wanted to, well, two things. I wanted to be in a space by myself where I had to face my writing, mm-hmm. and the other thing was, I could do a little research in Toronto. There was a guy there called Paul St. Clair who worked for a settlement agency, and he worked specifically with Slovak Roma. Mm-hmm. And so he was a really important person to talk to. There was also a Roma, okay, am I going to get this right? I think it's community center there. And I never got there. I contacted them and I can't even remember why I never got there. But I had hoped to go there. But through Paul, I actually met a Roma man who I talked to briefly. I don't think his English was very strong, but he was with Paul when I was interviewing Paul for a little while. And so I took his last name mm-hmm. for one of the characters. And yeah.
Cool. And so do you need that focus when you're writing? Like, do you need to sort of have the rest of the world taken away? It helps a lot of people.
Well, you know, I usually don't. Like, I like to write in coffee shops before COVID. I like the noise going on around me. I don't like it when I can actually hear other people's conversations, because then it's distracting. But mm-hmm. just the noise around me seems to help. But, you know, I did write in coffee shops in Toronto too, but the vibe was pretty different there, I felt, than here. So, you know, Toronto's a great place to visit, but I wouldn't want to live and work there personally.
Mm-hmm. It's a lot. A lot of staring into the middle distance in Toronto, seeing nothing. No one sees you.
Yeah. I'm sure there's a lot of good points about Toronto, including some I could name, but, you know, it's just not my cup of tea.
That's fair. You have a lot of different languages in the book. Before you kind of brought these consultants in, how did you actually, what was the process of writing that? Would you just sort of go, what I want it to say in the language? You would just write it in English? Or do you know some of the language?
I know a little Slovak, and I also use some Google Translate.
Yeah.
And then I have a couple, a friend in the Czech Republic who was born in Slovakia. So she looked over the language initially, but that was just not the whole manuscript. That was just some of the Slovak that I pulled out of the manuscript and let her like look at it line by line. So she did some of that. And then I had a sensitivity reader. Oh, so that was earlier on. That was sort of let me see, it might even have been before I submitted it. No, it was after I submitted it to Invisible. And then I had a sensitivity reader, so I got another grant from Arts Nova Scotia in 2020 to hire two sensitivity readers in 2021, mm-hmm. and found Petra Gelbart by some amazing synchronicity, and she was my Roma reader, mm-hmm. and she was amazing. She also had some Slovak relatives, so she went through some of the Slovak, especially after I had added some, and she added the Romani language as mm-hmm. well, which I hadn't used. But then I realized when Milan's family is talking to each other, they wouldn't be talking Slovak, they'd be talking Romani.
Right.
So she added that. So I'm very grateful for that.
And you also had Jen Schwartz.
Yes, Jen. Yeah, and she was the disability sensitivity reader. I think it was the first time that she'd been a sensitivity reader, same as Petra. And her background is more editing, I think. So Jen Schwartz, she brought an editor's eye to the manuscript and also helped me with the accuracy and the realism around some of the details with disability.
Mm-hmm. One of the characters is in a wheelchair.
Well,
I do want. Have you worked with sensitivity readers before? Is that a common practice to bring people on?
That was Stephanie's idea.
Of course, it was.
I never heard of sensitivity readers actually before Stephanie mentioned them, and I never worked with them before, and I'm glad I did. I'm really glad I did.
Yeah, and was that sort of a nerve-wracking experience? Because you don't want to be inherently don't want to be offensive, but the point of having these people is to kind of highlight the ways that you don't realize mm-hmm. that you're being insensitive.
Right.
So when you kind of handed it over to those people, was it stressful for you to get to read those notes?
No, they were both kind. And also, by the time they got a hold of it, I think Stephanie had already chopped out some bits that, you know, probably weren't, that I didn't write very skillfully. And so had Lee, the publisher, who acted as the copy editor later. So, yeah, it was okay. Their feedback was mostly quite positive. Mm-hmm. Some of the details that needed cleaning up were things that it helped it become a more realistic portrayal.
Right.
I think there wasn't too much that was sort of totally offensive. I'm hoping. I wasn't told if there was.
Right, right. So this metaphor of the river that, you know, Joan is kind of following it through her travels. Is that something that always existed in the story, or did you pull it in from somewhere at a certain point?
Well, the original title, the working title of this book was Slipstreaming, which I guess is used in skateboarding.
I would not know.
Yeah, me neither. I just looked it up and thought, oh, I like that.
It's a cool name. Yeah, it's a cool word.
To be in someone's slipstream, or like geese flying, they're kind of being pulled by the draft of the bird ahead of them. So so I sort of envisioned Joan doing that, and slipstream is also like it's a watery term too.
Yeah.
So I have a real affinity for water, I think, mm-hmm. and the Danube River, or Dunaj in Slovak, is very, it's very evocative, it's a very important river for Europe, and for many reasons, historical and cultural and, you know, all sorts of things. So mm-hmm. I see rivers as kind of carriers of those things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. As well as just water moving.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, water's a great metaphor for lots of stuff.
Yeah.
But it also factors in a lot. There's story points that it taps into as well. Yeah. I want to ask you, so Joan, there's two points in the story where Joan, something happens and she immediately goes, I'm out.
Okay.
Like one bad thing happens.
Yeah.
It's like, we're not going to deal with this. I'm done. I'm leaving. She does that twice.
Yeah.
I don't even know what my question is. I'm just like, what's the deal with that? What's behind that? Like, you know, it speaks to something in her character. And, you know, and I'm not going to blow the ending, but, you know, she's kind of still moving, even though the title has ends in it, she's still moving at the end. Mm-hmm. What makes her flee?
That's a good point, because Joan kind of inertia has a lot of place in Joan's life, so staying in one place is easy for her. But of course, the first time she flees Budapest, she's leaving a bad roommate situation, and one of the themes in this book is that she is looking for escape routes everywhere, like to always know there's a way she can get out of a situation. And it's not made a big deal of, it's not really, she's not that conscious of it all the time, but she does look around for those things. And so I guess her relationship with this roommate in Budapest was always kind of like, I don't really know. and you know why she leaves.
Yes.
Would be a pretty uncomfortable situation to stay in.
Mm-hmm.
The second time she kind of leaves is when she's working for the Burns family, and something happens that she gets angry about and also doesn't feel comfortable staying. And she does go back to the hotel Svetopluk, where her friends live. And I think, you know, she's okay with leaving things, jobs included.
Yeah.
It's hard for her to commit to people and to things, I guess. In some ways, inertia is great. It kept her in her job in Hungary for a while, but commitment is not her big thing.
Yeah, and it's also not, she's very aware of it. She knows she's a drifter. She knows she doesn't have any direction. So it's not like a big flaw. I just read it and I go, wow, I wish I could be like this. It's like a thing goes bad, I'm like, bye.
That's interesting.
Yeah. I admire that.
I didn't see it as a, like a really positive character trait.
No, I mean,
also like,
yeah. You know,
yeah.
But to take yourself out of a bad situation immediately, not like trying to talk it out or like brush it off and see what happens down the road. It's sort of like, no, you know, this road goes nowhere. Right. I like that. I directness and decisiveness, even though she is a drifter, I appreciate that. You deal with a lot of themes of class and race in this book. Mm-hmm. What is it? What do you want people to take from all the sort of angles that you're exploring amongst cultural, economic, all that stuff? Sort of a very broad question. What would you be able to take away?
Well, good question. I guess I wanted to explore those ideas and about, you know, the power of money, what it can do in a person's life and what it does when you don't have it. Race is big on everyone's mind, I think has been for the past few years. But for me, that started when I was in Slovakia and saw this weird, weird thing. Like, Roma people were quite marginalized and looked down on by a lot of Slovaks. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's uncommon in many parts of Europe. I don't think it's just Slovakia. But on the other hand, indigenous North American people were kind of like, romanticized. And like you probably have heard about this phenomenon in Germany where maybe not, but
not with you yet, but maybe.
It's quite, you know, indigenous culture is quite popular. And so I sort of saw that, and the Oka crisis happened when I was in Slovakia too. Right. And so it was interesting people's reactions to that. I didn't know much about the issues at all at that time. So for me, it was like, what's going on right. in Canada? You know, but so I, since that time, for 30 years, I've kind of been turning it over in my mind a little bit. And I wanted to write some Roma characters that were real people and because I also wanted to talk about money and the power of money, a lot of Roma people are, you know, they're living hand to mouth in mm-hmm. Slovakia, and just like oppressed people everywhere, they're not rolling in dough, a lot of them. Mm-hmm. So there was a good intersection there.
Mm-hmm. And you all, and Joan's interesting too, where she always seems to have money. She kind of lucks into jobs, but she also says, again, like she's very self-aware. She says, you know, her parents are never going to let her be homeless.
Right.
So yeah. Indicating that she's been helped out along the way.
Yeah. Well, in the first novel I wrote, Joan lived at home, mm-hmm. like till she was 30 something. Mm-hmm. And and she, you know, either lost or quit jobs, or well, mostly quit jobs. Always was a bit of a misfit. And, you know, I relate to that. Like I also have lived at home off and on mm-hmm. all through my life. And now I live with my dad, who's almost 90, and, you know, we're roommates. you know, my parents have helped me a great deal. And I kind of had never realized how much that did for my life until quite recently. You know, like I didn't realize the privilege in that, and I didn't realize the kind of foundation that it gave me to do other things like write, make art, whatever. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I, to me, that Joan is pretty close to me in many ways.
Right.
Yeah.
Very cool. Do you want to give us a little taste of this novel?
Okay, sure. So in the passage I'm about to read, Joan is on the train from leaving Budapest to go to Bratislava. And she is sort of hanging out the window, even though it's sort of late October, early November. Okay. Joan spoke into the dark rush of wind past her face, releasing all the Hungarian she knew. The words slipped away as though carried by a current, back in the direction from which she'd come. From now on, it would be Slovak, a mildly enemy language to Tibor's Hungarian friends. They had told her how the Hungarians who visited Slovakia were treated as second-class citizens, regarded with suspicion, veiled hostility, and outright contempt. Some had been beaten. As though we were no better than Tsiganyuk, one woman with quivering jowls had sputtered. Gypsies, Joan had learned over her 4 years in Hungary, was a derogatory term for Roma people, one that she, like most people she'd known in Canada, had used without knowing. With a Roma so despised that even Tibor's bragged band of friends looked down upon them. As if on cue, a Romani mother with a baby brushed past Joan on the train, hips swaying, peaceful and relaxed, as though she were strolling in a garden. Joan caught a whiff of her own foreignness. It was she who was the intruder here, the stilted stranger. But the Romani woman had not guarded herself or her child. She had walked by her as if Joan were not even there, though her jeans brushed Joan's legs, and the charms on her gold bracelet, tinkling softly as she passed, seemed meant to announce her presence to the world. A few young Slovaks who had clearly been drinking boarded the train with a German shepherd at one of the small town stops. Joan retreated to the cabin where her suitcases sat and shut the door. There was no escape route now, and her breath fluttered in her chest. She could hear loud voices, but it was not long before they quieted, and Joan thought they must have fallen asleep. She felt herself nodding off, but jerked awake as the train's brakes squealed at the next town. When the train started moving again, she heard the call for the next stop in the conductor's bored-sounding voice, Bratislava. Joan stood up, unbalanced. Her luggage steadied her. She headed down the narrow passageway, swaying uncertainly with the train's motion. A couple cabins away, the young Slovak men were sprawled asleep, while the German Shepherd, its dirty coat uncared for and its large head and ears perked attentively, peered at her. There were food wrappers and bottles scattered across the floor and seats, and the young men were arranged haphazardly, their scrawny limbs flung everywhere, their faces gray and open-mouthed. A couple people disembarked the train before Joan. The Roma woman and her baby were nowhere to be seen. Perhaps they'd gotten off at a previous stop, Joan thought. She hoped so, and that the drunken young men had not seen them before they fell asleep. Joan had been careful in Budapest not to be out alone in the dark. Here, too, in yet another strange city, she felt a jagged danger. She hesitated before descending the steps to the platform. Though anchored for the moment by her luggage, Joan felt a dizzying sensation, like she was spiraling down into the watery depths of a river she could not name.
Awesome. And so that's really where the journey begins for this story. So metaphor. I'm not good with metaphor. Does it come to you easily? Do you sit there and go, like, as, like, are you just matching things up? Do you see it? It's a foreign writing concept to me. I'm just not really, I don't do it well.
It's interesting you ask that because I think for me, metaphor is, it's like a very real thing. I don't think, oh, what's a good metaphor, like what's a good metaphor for life, a river, or for time, a river, whatever. It feels like it's inherent in the in what a river is to me, so I guess that's my answer, is that it does come quite naturally.
That's very cool. I'm jealous about that. So how long does it take you to write a book? And people hate this when you have them on. You go, what's your next thing? It's like, but we're here to talk about this. But I am interested. How long does it take you generally? And do you have the next one in mind? Let's say that.
Well, generally, it takes me several years. And this one, I wrote on and off over 7 years, I think. Mm-hmm. I'm not a person who sits down and writes every single day, 7 days a week, 365 mm-hmm. days a year. So it could take someone a lot less time than that. And as far as like my next thing, oh my gosh, it's a hard question, but I'm contemplating the fact that Joan is, at the end of this book, is also going off on another adventure. Mm-hmm. And maybe I need to follow her and do some traveling and research. Although I don't want to travel anymore.
Yeah.
And COVID has taken that out of me. But also I feel like I'm 53 and I want to stay home. So I'm not sure whether I'll follow this novel with another one with Joan, but I love the character of Joan if she feels real to me, and I never feel like I'm done with her.
Yeah, I wanted to know what happened over there. Does each novel normally, I mean, I know the sensitivity readers are new, but is there normally as much research and as much consulting as you did for this one?
Oh, not for me. Like, I think most of my other two novels were taken from my own pretty much experience. Mm-hmm. This one I did more research, but I think as far as research goes, this is not a heavily researched book. I'm worried sometimes about how it will be received for a number of reasons. Because I sort of feel that, I mean, I could have gone to Bratislava. I could have done a lot more research about Bratislava and about different aspects of the characters. But they come to me almost like full-fledged people already. Mm-hmm. So research is kind of, it feels like an add-on in some ways.
And I would think it would add a distance too. Like, mm-hmm. I would think then it becomes more academic and less about the art.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, some novels are very well researched, and I'm sure they accomplish amazing things. But, I'm not the kind of writer that spends a lot of time delving into the stuff other than the characters, I think.
Yeah. I'm like that too.
Yeah.
Yeah. You need character. Yeah. That's really the beginning and end of it for me. Anna, thanks so much for coming on. This is your first podcast, correct?
Yeah, I think it is.
I love when that happens. And congratulations on the book. It's called Where the Silver River Ends, available at Bookmark and other local booksellers.
Yes.
Yes.
And possibly, I think Coles and Chapters has it.
Oh, terrific.
You can get it online from Invisible and all the usual suspects, but yeah, go to Bookmark and the King's Co-op bookstore.
There you go. Thanks so much.
Okay.
Take care.
Bye.
Where the Silver River Ends will officially be launched on Friday, March 11th at 7 p.m. This is a virtual event and it's free, but you'll need to book tickets through Side Door. Anna will be joined by two of the people she mentioned on the show, her editor Stephanie Domet and her sensitivity reader Jen Schwartz, who will also share their work. Register now at sidedooraccess.com. Sideline is engineered by Palmer Jameson at the Golden Palm and produced by the Halifax Examiner.